This episode of Shameless is brought to you by Majuri. This Mother's Day, show appreciation with jewelry styles they'll love forever.
She's the woman who inspired the final track on Taylor Swift's new album, The Tortured Poets Department. So we wondered, who was Clara Bow? The answer took us on a fascinating path. Welcome to Scandal from Shameless Podcast, the stories of the biggest celebrity controversies revisited.
Hello, Zara McDonald.
Hello, Michelle Andrews. We are back for part two of two on Clara Bow.
We are indeed. In episode one, we spoke about how Clara's poor upbringing and her mentally unwell grandmother, as well as her mentally unwell mother, impacted her as a person. We also spoke about a generational cycle of abuse when it came to the men in the family.
Yeah, we did. At the age of 13, we spoke about how Clara entered herself into like a magazine competition called the Fame and Fortune Contest with, I think it was with Motion Picture Magazine. Mm. The first prize in this contest was a part in a movie. Lo and behold, she won that competition and so began her career in silent films.
Clara's mother died when she was 17 years old, and although Clara's mum was abusive, it did devastate Clara a lot to lose her. Her career at this point in time was going from strength to strength. She was starring in movies in New York City. That year she moved to Hollywood. She was making more money when she was just a teenager than her family had ever seen.
And didn't her dad like that?
Oh,
quite
dear.
A lot. Bye. Her early 20s, she was like the premier flapper of her generation. She was the first it girl ever. And she had a pretty mammoth contract with Paramount to boot. And what we spoke a lot about in the last episode was the most important detail in this contract was that she didn't have a morals clause, which was really rare, which meant they couldn't fire her for bad behavior. They did, though, sneak in another clause in the contract. We spoke about how $25,000 was deposited into a trust over the course of her contract, which did hinge on her conduct. And she'd kind of get that money at the end of the contract if she behaved herself.
Like a nice bonus.
Yeah, but if she was involved in public scandal, she wouldn't get the money.
We will be keeping that top of mind for today's ep. So too will we be chatting about the fact that Clara had lots of boyfriends often at the same time. When we left off, Clara had just met Earl Pearson. We told you her relationship with him would just about ruin her career. We are rewinding Zara back to 1928 and picking up there.
Alrighty, Mish. So we're in 1928. By this time, 23-year-old Clara had been dating Earl Pearson for about 8 months. He was married, remember? He kept assuring Clara that his marriage was loveless, that he planned to divorce his wife. So Clara started getting confident.
Yeah, here's how she spoke about Earl in one interview at the time. I have found the one man who brings complete happiness into living. I am sorry, but I cannot tell you his name. He is not in the motion picture profession. I would gladly tell you if it weren't that I must protect him. He is married. He has not been living with his wife. There are no children. I love him. As to my getting married, if it were possible now, I'd do it.
Interesting. Now, because Clara wasn't exactly subtle with her affairs, Elizabeth Pearson, Earl's wife, quickly cottoned on to what was happening. She confronted Earl, and Earl openly admitted to her that he was in love with Clara, hoping that this would like speed up the divorce proceedings. It definitely did speed them up, but not in the way that Earl and Clara kind of hoped for.
No, as per Ronan Wild, that biography we are leaning a lot on in this series, Elizabeth Pearson informed her husband that she would cite Clara Bow as co-respondent in her complaint and bring suit for alienation of affections against her. She would seek $150,000 in damages. Zara, what is alienation of affections?
This is fascinating. I'm kind of obsessed with this. So alienation of affections is a charge that doesn't exist anymore. But basically, it meant you could sue the person who had an affair with your spouse if the affair was reason for divorce. This should be everywhere now. You should be able to sue.
What the fuck?
Isn't this perfect?
I mean, I love it and I can see why it also doesn't exist anymore at the same time.
This was, goes without saying, I think, the kind of publicity that Clara Bow did not need. The story hadn't gone public yet, but Clara and her lawyer at Paramount would have to work very quickly to ensure that this didn't hit the media.
Mm, luckily for Paramount, this was exactly the kind of scandal that allowed them to keep hold of that $25,000 trust from Clara. Now, on top of that trust, she also actually had a $10,000 bonus per movie in a separate account with a similar setup, in that Clara wouldn't get those bonuses until her contract expired. Those bonuses also hinged on her behavior. She had done 3 movies since this new contract came into effect. So there was $30,000 in that account and $25,000 in the other.
Yeah, so Paramount kind of jumped into action. They cancelled her $25,000 trust, and even though it wasn't a public scandal, it caused enough strife for them that they were legally able to withhold the money from Clara. What they did after that is their publicist prepared a statement from Clara in the event that the story did go public, which it would if Elizabeth actually named Clara in her divorce suit. And why wouldn't she? Now, this statement read in part, "I am not purposely hunting for newly wedded husbands. I can't use all my spare time to shoo them away. It is regrettable, of course, if true, that Dr. Pearson has lost any affection which he may have had for his wife, but I deny I had anything to do with it. Clara doesn't scare." So good.
The final damage control move that Paramount made was to offer Elizabeth Pearson a lot of money to leave Clara's name out of the divorce proceedings. So, where did they get this money? Well, Paramount offered Elizabeth Pearson the $30,000 that Clara had made in movie bonuses. So they hold on to their $25,000 and they go, well, we've got this other account of $30,000. Let's give this to the aggrieved, estranged wife and hope it's like hush money.
Totally. So all up, her affair with Earl Pearson was now costing Clara $55,000, which according to our trusty inflation calculator would now amount to over $1 million in 2024. The same day that she got the $30,000 offer, Elizabeth Pearson filed for divorce from Earl. She didn't name Clara in the divorce. Clara's statement never went public, probably good for that.
Very good.
And the scandal didn't reach reporters yet.
Yet. Dot, dot, dot. Yet. As for her romance with Earl, Clara unsurprisingly cooled on him after spending $55,000 on their love. She left his love letters unanswered and he essentially just kind of slinked out of her life. Is that the way to put it? Slunk out of her life?
Yeah, sure. Either or.
No one could blame her for being a little distracted because, if you can believe it, Zara, Clara Bow actually had a much bigger problem on her hands.
Yeah. Now, remember we said the 1920s were an amazing time in technological advancements, particularly in film? Well, by 1928, there'd been one major development in the film world that pretty much changed everything, and that was the talkies. Over the last year or so, major movie studios had been experimenting with recording dialogue in films, and they found that audiences reacted really positively to the concept of sound on film. Now, at first, the movies only had like little sections of recorded sound, but pretty quickly, the technology became sophisticated enough to create entire films with recorded sound, including dialogue.
It's amazing how quickly talkies became the standard. As per Run and Wild, in 1928, the majority of American movies were silent. By 1930, all was sound.
That is such an amazing thing to look at, how quickly the industry adapted. Now, the thing for Clara here and every working actor in Hollywood is that they would have to adjust, and it did fundamentally change their job. Mm. Every actor was worried about how their voice would come across on film, how they would manage now that their craft had changed. Theatre actors actually started getting sent out to Hollywood, and film actors were very anxious that they would soon be out of a job, and fair enough.
Yeah, and no one was more anxious than Clara Bow. She was obviously at the top of her game, and everyone wanted to see Clara in a talkie. But Clara, as we've told you guys, had a lifelong stutter and a brash, thick Brooklyn accent. She was petrified of the idea of being in a talkie. She was also completely terrified of learning lines. She felt this anxiety that there was no way she'd be able to remember a full film's worth of dialogue.
Yeah, and fair enough too.
Well, I wouldn't want to do it.
No. Well, that's we're not actors. So. Speaking about Clara's anxiety about talkies to the BBC, film critic Leonard Maltin said, for stars like Clara, who had no stage background, no theatrical training, and who may have depended in large part on a director taking her through a scene, which now wouldn't be possible with a microphone present, this was enormously frightening. And it came at a time when she was at the peak of box office success. She was scared to death. Didn't think about how... with silent films, the director literally probably could be in your ear saying, move your face this way and your arm this way and do this. Yep. Like you could be spoon-fed an entire movie.
100%. I think it's so much of it, of course, it relied on some kind of acting. Like the way your body moves, the way your face looks, of course, that's all really important. Largely, though, I think it hinged on your appearance, like your genetics and what you were born with. On top of all this, all Paramount actors had been subjected to voice tests at this time, which were essentially like a make or break test for how their voice sounded when recorded. Although Clara's test technically went off without a hitch, she was horrified by the result. As per Runnin' Wild, the sound of herself on screen was everything she had expected and worse. Clara was inconsolable. How can I be in pictures with a voice like that? She wailed. Then she burst into tears. As a podcaster who had to hear her voice for the first time ago, I relate to this.
We get it. Even though Clara was devastated by her voice test, Paramount proceeded with production on her first talkie. Now, she filmed her test in December 1928. She began work on this film, The Wild Party, on Jan 2, 1929. Other actresses, for context, were given years to prepare for their first speaking roles in films. Paramount gave Clara a couple of weeks. And again, as we mentioned before, I can understand why this happened. She was at the peak of her fame, peak of box office success. You're not going to pull her out of the industry for 3 years while you got her ready. Yeah. You would just drop her in and hope it worked.
Even though filming The Wild Party was arduous for Clara, when it was released, audiences loved it. Her fans were thrilled and critics specifically praised her voice and her performance. Here's one from the New York Times. Miss Bo's voice is better than the narrative of the film. It is not over melodious in delivery, but it suits her personality. During the press run for The Wild Party, Clara confessed her true feelings about the rapidly changing landscape. She said, I ain't so crazy about the movie business like I once was.
Yeah, luckily for Clara, she had a new best friend to help her through it. It was a hairdresser by the name of Daisy DeVoe.
I'm obsessed with this name as well.
Same. It just sounds like a movie character, doesn't it? Daisy and Clara had a bunch in common. They both left school to start working at a really young age, and they both had pretty tough attitudes towards the pretty brutal industry that they both worked in. Daisy was appointed to Clara as her on-set hairdresser and was tasked with keeping Clara's hair dyed, her signature auburn red. This was a pretty lengthy process, so Daisy and Clara got to know each other very well, as do lots of women with their hairdressers.
Yeah. Eventually, as they got closer, Daisy learned more about Clara's personal life and was really shocked to find out where all her money was going. It turns out that around this time, Clara Bow supported her father, her cousin, and employed a pretty useless business manager called Bogart Rogers. She also hired a couple of house staff who had all been found to be taking advantage of her financially. Having all of these dependents, plus her father's unfortunate habit of using her money to start doomed businesses, meant that Clara was being absolutely bled dry.
Yeah, feeling for her friend or her very close new friend, Daisy was promoted from personal hairdresser to personal secretary and put in charge of Clara's finances. As per Runnin' Wild, Daisy struck back by firing Bogart Rogers, evicting Clara's cousin, Billy Bow, and cutting off Robert's access to Clara's account. Daisy also became a bit of a buffer between Clara and the staff at Paramount.
Girl boss.
Sort of like a manager, like a modern day manager, I guess.
Yeah, for Clara, this was a huge relief. For everyone who was used to having untethered access to her and her finances, though, it was a big annoyance.
Fair.
Knowing that Clara planned to retire from movies when her contract expired, you know, she was planning on making as much money as possible and retiring in her 20s. Daisy helped Clara open a savings account. Now that her Paramount Trust had been drained after the Elizabeth Pearson scandal, Clara needed to save more than ever.
Yeah, so Daisy established a new trust. It was Clara's own trust to deposit half her salary into each week. Now, in addition to this, she started a new special account that only she and Clara had access to. So what she did is she basically gave Clara an allowance from this account and took her own $75 weekly salary from it as well.
Clara continued to suffer from pretty awful mic fright and still really struggled to keep her eyes off the overhead mic setup when she was shooting her films. It all just felt like a different world to her and she wasn't adapting.
This mic fright thing is really interesting to me. It's almost like she had this visceral response when a mic was above her head, where she would get anxious and not be able to get her lines out. And this is why she struggled so much shooting these films. On the set of her latest film, she was so exhausted and anxious from ruining take after take that she swore into the microphone, burst into tears, and curled up in a ball on the ground. Rumours of this breakdown spread around Hollywood really quickly, and word on the street was that Clara could not handle the talkies. We're going to talk more about how that transpired after the break.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and if you're anything like us, you want to make sure the motherly figures in your life feel extra special this year.
That's right, Mish, and we've got just the thing to make their day unforgettable. Majuri are the experts at everyday fine jewellery, so it goes without saying they are the number one destination this Mother's Day.
Yeah, Majuri have just released three limited edition sets: the Stacker Necklace set, the Everyday set, and the Convertible Hoop set. I personally have my eye on the Stacker Necklace set for my mum. It's great for an everyday look.
Honestly, you cannot go wrong with giving the best person a best-selling style. Plus, these gift sets are 10% off. Now, that's what we call a win-win.
But listen up, because we've got some important dates to remember. The last order date for personalised products is May 1st, and for in-stock pieces, it's May 6th at 8:59 p.m. AEST.
So don't sleep on this one, people. Let's make sure your loved one gets the royal treatment she deserves. Head over to Majuri now and make this Mother's Day the best one yet with Majuri.
Thank you so much to Majuri for making this episode of Shameless possible. All right, Zara. So filming the talkies obviously left Clara vulnerable. Around this time, Photoplay, that magazine we referenced in Ep 1, printed the following quote from Clara, which gave some insight into her emotional state at the time. "If only I could find the right man, someone who would give me something. I'm unhappy, desolate. My mind goes on even when my body sleeps. I've always given. I've had no childhood, my mother's illness, her horrible death, the demands that have always, always been made upon me. But I could be happy, I believe, if I could find the right man."
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that she wasn't feeling in the best frame of mind when she met the actor Harry Richman. Now, by the time he got to Hollywood, 33-year-old Harry Richman was intent on achieving celebrity status, just wanted to be famous. He was also obsessed with women. Take this from his memoir: "Don Juan himself never had more girls. Without bragging, I can say I had every single one I went after. Every well-known whore in the country was my friend."
Harry.
Again, excuse the language. Now, Don Juan was, of course, that fictional character who devoted his life to seducing women.
Okay,
Don Juan himself never had more girls.
So Clara and Harry met in 1929, and desperate for comfort, Clara fell hard for him even from their very first date. Harry could not believe his luck. Daisy DeVoe, on the other hand, described Harry as a scum bum. She said he used Clara for her fame.
Yeah, Clara and Harry were very public with their relationship. Here's what Harry later wrote about how his celebrity grew when he was with Clara. "Because I was seen with her everywhere, people began to recognize me. The newspapers would print photographs of us on the front pages. If one of us went out without the other, the reporters would make an issue out of it. I began to feel like a star myself."
All his dreams are coming true. The problem was the public and the media had started to turn on Clara and scrutinize her romantic life. By this point in time, she had been engaged 3 times before Harry, and now, according to reports, she was engaged to get married for a 4th time. One newspaper wrote, "Clara's engagements are about as frequent and enduring as the average girl's headaches." As if things couldn't get worse, Clara had gained a little bit of weight for her latest film, The Saturday Night Kid, and it was all the critics could talk about.
Yeah, although she wasn't feeling great at this time, Clara gradually realised that Harry was pretty much only with her for the publicity, so she regularly cheated on him with Gary Cooper. Do we remember him?
Well, Eilish has put in her notes, in brackets, remember him, and I actually don't.
It's like...
Gary Cooper.
He was one of her early... Let's go back. He was that really hot actor that they worked
Yes, we looked up the photos of him and we decided he was very hot.
When she was engaged to poor Gilbert Roland. And Gary Cooper was the final straw for Gilbert after she cheated on him like 100 times.
Oh, what a memory.
So she started cheating on Harry Richman with Gary Cooper. I think it's also worth clarifying and reminding the audience at this time, this was a really bad time for Clara mentally. She was constantly anxious. She was struggling to adjust to this rapidly changing industry. She was really intimidated by the expectations placed on her. She knew Harry was exploiting her. She couldn't sleep. Daisy DeVoe was really the only person holding her together, both financially and emotionally.
Something had to give. And for now, it was her relationship with Harry Richman. Despite his very loud public proclamations of love, Clara made a statement to reporters that clarified she no longer had any intention of marrying him. And just as well, Zara, because she was about to meet her husband.
Yes, 25-year-old Rex Bell was a stunt horseman. He was working mainly in westerns, which were growing in popularity at the time. When he met Clara on the film set for True to the Navy, she was technically engaged to Harry. She was also casually seeing a guy called Gwyn Williams. By now, we know for sure that our girl Clara can have two guys on the go pretty well, and it wouldn't stop her from picking up a third.
No, the thing was, this new relationship with Rex Bell quickly became the most important out of all of Clara's lovers, and this time things were different. Rex and Clara were the real deal. Obviously, Clara's father, Robert Beau, hated him, but that didn't bother her as much as the fact that her best friend, Daisy, hated Rex Bell too.
Yeah, I think Daisy was likely scarred by the fame-hungry Harry Richman and also the disaster that was Earl Pearson, that she was pretty suspicious of Rex and felt that, you know, he was just out to use Clara. Rex was kind of caught off guard by Daisy's hatred of him. And actually also felt similarly about Daisy. He felt that she had too much control over Clara's finances.
Rex and Daisy's feud would reach a boiling point soon, one that would have pretty devastating consequences for them all. But before we get there, we need to talk about how a long-buried scandal was just about to rear its ugly head again.
Yes, sometime in June 1930, Clara somehow discovered that Elizabeth Pearson, here she's back, Earl Pearson's wife, had never received the $30,000 Paramount had promised her for keeping Clara out of the divorce papers. As it turned out, Elizabeth and Earl reconciled and hadn't got divorced after all.
Elizabeth, you could do so much better. I know this happened literally almost 100 years ago.
I know. Clara being Clara, though, promptly travelled to Elizabeth's house in Dallas to find out what happened to the money.
Clara makes so many bad choices. I love her, but come on.
She travelled under a fake name, but reporters weren't fooled. They knew it was Clara Beau.
Yeah. As word spread that Clara was in Dallas, reporters clamoured around her at her hotel and hounded her with questions. She was able to keep it together until one daring reporter asked, "Aren't you here to pay Earl Pearson's wife $150,000? We don't know how this reporter came across this information, but Clara, our girl, unfortunately fell for the baiting question. She fell for it hook, line, and sinker. She responded to the reporter, "That bitch, I already gave her 30 grand and I ain't paying another cent." She then went on to explain the full reason why she was in Dallas to track down where the missing $30,000 went.
The newspapers were thrilled, understandably. This was about as salacious a story you could get. And it made the front page news for weeks. Paramount were annoyed. Not only had Clara travelled to Dallas without their permission and caused a massive scandal, but she'd already forfeited the trust. So they had no other way of punishing her. So they couldn't fire her because of that no morals clause. So where was that $30,000? As per Run and Wild, Paramount claimed Elizabeth Pearson had received it. Elizabeth Pearson claimed she'd refused it. Clara didn't have the money. Who did?
This shocked me, finding out who had this money.
Mr. Earl.
Earl Pearson. Dr. Earl Pearson had somehow circumvented the money from reaching his wife and used it to start his own private urology practice.
It's just like not the plot twist. It's not just that he ended up with it. He used it. I mean, with great respect to urology practices, but wow.
It's not the sexiest use of 30 grand though, is it?
No. He and Clara never spoke again, and we don't know whether or not Clara ever learned where her money ended up. But she didn't have much time to mull over this scandal because another one was just around the corner.
Yeah, we're actually taking a tiny detour to explain what the 1930s were like in the US before we tell you about this specific scandal. Because we've officially hit the 1930s in our timeline, Zaz. The glow and prosperity of the Roaring Twenties was becoming a distant memory the following decade. Every social movement, as we know, in history seems to have almost an equal opposite movement. And the freedom and outrageousness of the 1920s was now being replaced by much more conservative values in the 30s.
Yeah, it's that, I don't know, seesaw we see all the time throughout history. Mm. You know, Obama to Trump to Biden to God knows what could happen next. It's a tale as old as time. The Great Depression was on the horizon as well. Technically, major economic downturn had already begun by this point. The general public had less money. It made wealthy celebrities a lot easier to resent. I don't think we're telling the audience anything they don't know, perhaps right now.
Yeah, I was about to say, almost what I guess our best reference for this 100 years on is the way celebrities were spoken about and considered and influencers were spoken about and considered in lockdown.
Yes.
Our animosity towards them, it was like love to hate them energy. Now, in the 1930s, unfortunately for Clara, she became the perfect target for this kind of vitriol. She was beautiful, she was successful, she was wealthy, she was the poster child for the Roaring Twenties. And so she was the ultimate object of resentment and ridicule instead of being this aspirational, enviable celebrity she had been the decade prior.
Yeah, take this from a magazine at the time called Silver Screen. This snippet is from an article with the headline, "Why Can't the It Girl Keep Her Men?" This is what it read. "At the moment, the thing to do is to knock Clara Bow. Let's admit she's been making an idiot of herself in the papers. Off the screen, Clara has reigned in the hearts of many men. She's been engaged and engaged, yet no man has led her to the altar. Why can't the It Girl get her man?"
Then there was also this from Photoplay magazine. "Clara, at the age of 25, doesn't seem to have learned a thing about governing her life. Still behaving like a headstrong high school girl with forbidden dates and wild crushes. Will Clara not soak up the indisputable fact that the dittos and flummadiddies, which are..."
Flummadiddles. I appreciate why you don't know what that word is.
"Which are cute and cunning at 18 are only sad and unpleasant aberrations in a woman of 25. Now,
how language changes. Can we bring flummadiddles back?
Well, dittos and flummadiddles, according to Eilish Gilligan, it means tricks and nonsense.
Yeah. Flummadiddle, if you Google it, is sort of something foolish or worthless, nonsense or trash.
Flummadiddles.
I'm absolutely fucking using that.
Can we actually start? This can be a little packed with the scandal listeners. On an episode of our Thursday,
I'm going to try and drop it in.
One of us just drops in flummadiddles, no one reacts, and it's just a little in-joke with the scandal listeners.
But I'm not doing this in the next few weeks. This could be in like 2 months' time, 3 months' time. I'm going to remember it for them.
No, we have to.
Flummadiddles.
Flummadiddles.
By this stage, BP Schulman, Clara's boss at Paramount, had taken to calling her Crisis A Day Clara. And although the nickname is a bit cruel, it's not hard to see why it stuck. Like, there were a lot of scandals. Rex and Clara, for what it's worth, were still going strong. But the sad fact was the animosity between Rex and Daisy DeVoe was almost impossible to bear. And Daisy seemed to understand that she was likely fighting a losing battle.
Daisy said years later, "I wasn't sleeping with Clara. Rex Bell had that edge on me." Sometime around September 1930, so only a matter of weeks after the Earl Pearson scandal had made front page news, Daisy DeVoe was taking a quick nap in her office at Clara's house when she was woken up by a conversation between Rex and Clara, In that conversation, Rex was telling Clara that he was more qualified than Daisy to control Clara's finances. Daisy was shocked. To her, this seemed to prove that Rex was trying to get her out of the way to take advantage of Clara, just like every other man kind of before him had done.
Yeah, so when she was alone, Daisy took everything out of her office file cabinet, the special account checkbook, the one that only she and Clara could access, business documents and personal letters from Clara's lovers. I don't know why she needed those. Mm. She stored the checkbook in a safe at the bank and kept everything else until she could kind of warn Clara about Rex.
Yeah, Rex quickly discovered the empty filing cabinet and seemed to prove his suspicions about Daisy. From what he could tell, Daisy had just robbed his girlfriend of her most valuable items. Clara was kind of stuck in the middle, right?
Yeah.
She didn't quite buy Rex's story. She was unable to believe that her best friend would be capable of that. But that didn't stop Rex from immediately changing the locks on Clara's house. When Daisy arrived the next day to give her warning to Clara, she found that the housekeeper had been ordered to not let her inside. The animosity between Rex and Daisy had reached fever pitch and things were about to actually get way worse.
Yeah. Unfortunately, way, way worse. Daisy had been in charge for Clara's finances for nearly 2 years at this point, and it had made a huge difference. According to Run and Wild, when Daisy was hired, the opening balance of her personal trust, so not the one controlled by Paramount, was $16,000. Now that balance was at $249,000.
Bro, Daisy.
Now I know what the listeners are thinking. What's that with the inflation calculator? 4.6 million USD, guys.
Nice. All thanks to Daisy, Clara could now retire at the end of her Paramount contract the following year, which was all she had ever wanted or dreamed of. And now it seemed as though Clara, through Rex, was kicking the woman who made all of that possible out.
Mm.
Daisy got in touch with a lawyer named Gilbert, who, fun fact, had actually been the same guy who managed to keep Clara out of Elizabeth Pearson's divorce filings when that scandal popped up. Anyway, Daisy told Gilbert to, and I quote, "tell Clara she can have her papers if she's willing to pay for them. Otherwise, I'm going to turn them over to the newspapers." So she's essentially blackmailing her with her personal letters and her business documents.
Yeah, look, not Daisy's finest moment. As per Run and Wild, Gilbert asked her price, $125,000 and not a nickel less, replied Daisy, deciding that she was entitled to half the trust fund she'd helped build.
It's getting hard to defend you, Daisy.
Yeah. Daisy knew full well that Clara's reputation hung in the balance. The tide was turning. The general public was souring on Clara already. If she had another major scandal, she'd be so maligned that Paramount might even be able to void her contract, morals clause or no morals clause. The day after Daisy issued this threat, she was overcome with remorse. This was her best.
Girl.
I mean, it was her best friend. So she turned up at Clara's house, hoping to resolve the issue, but Clara was having none of it.
Here's what Clara reportedly said to Daisy. "Ain't it true you went to Mr. Gilbert and said I had to pay you $125,000? Are you kidding me?" Now, Rex, who apparently was right by Clara's side when she said this, ordered Daisy to leave. Before Daisy left, though, she threatened Clara again, telling her that she would go to the newspapers if Clara didn't give Daisy her job back and forget the whole debacle. So Daisy really can't decide. She's very much got the devil and angel on her shoulder, and that devil getting loud.
Oh, getting real, real loud. Clara refused. And she was so incensed by what she saw as like Daisy's betrayal that she refused to drop it. Rex raided the safety deposit box at the bank after going through the special account checkbook and was shocked to find that Daisy had spent Clara's money on a whole bunch of things without Clara's explicit knowledge. Now, before you fully turn on Daisy DeVoe, it might be helpful knowing that she was responsible for sourcing and purchasing gifts for all of Clara's friends and colleagues, including Daisy herself. So, for example, Daisy purchased a diamond and platinum bow-shaped pin as a birthday gift from Clara to herself.
Yeah. It's just keep it in mind. There's shades of grey. Clara claimed that she had never seen this pin before in her life, which made her believe that Daisy had kind of, you know, bought it on the sly. In fact, decades later, here's what Daisy said about this diamond pin. "Clara had cheap taste and she knew it. I always picked out her gifts, even the ones for myself." It didn't really matter what Daisy said from this point forward. Both Clara and Rex now believed her to be a complete criminal. Clara pressed charges against Daisy for mismanagement of her funds. Daisy was thrown into jail and interrogated for 27 hours straight.
Wild. Now, Clara was so angry and so kind of blinded by this anger that she probably couldn't see that by filing this lawsuit, she was essentially shooting herself in the foot. Mm. I mean, nothing drew more attention from the press than a scandalous lawsuit between the most famous movie star in the world and her best friend over money.
Yeah.
Daisy managed to get herself out of custody after hiring her own lawyer, a guy named Nathan Friedman. She hit Clara with a lawsuit of her own for false arrest and $5,000 in damages.
What a mess. As per Run and Wild, based more on emotion than evidence, this was a case where justice could not possibly be served. As usual, Clara stood to suffer the most.
Mm.
As we know, Zara, Clara was self-conscious about her voice. This meant the prospect of testifying in front of a court was terrifying. Funnily enough, the concept was not so intimidating for Daisy. She even hinted to the delighted reporters, "Well, I'll tell the world a few things about Clara when I get on the witness stand."
The trial began on January 13, 1931, and it was huge. Thousands of people gathered outside the courthouse in an attempt to catch a glimpse of the feuding former best friends. Reporters recorded every moment of the trial and relayed it in their articles. It was everywhere. It's probably important to note here, Daisy maintained her cool, calm demeanor throughout. For some reason, she was like better prepped in this scenario than Clara, an actress, was. According to Run and Wild, in marked contrast to Daisy's stylish poise and brazen assurance, Clara entered the courtroom that morning clinging to Rex in mute terror. "She hates crowds," her lover told reporters as Clara held on to him silently. "She's scared to death to sit in the witness chair with everybody staring." No one disputed this, but his words did not help her case. Clara's fear seemed suspect in itself. If she was a victim and Daisy the villain, why worry?
Vicious cycle, I think. Yes. I don't think it's helpful at all for Rex to be like, "She's terrified."
Yeah, I know.
Daisy held absolutely nothing back in her testimony. In an attempt to distract from the charges against her, she focused on spilling secrets about Clara Bow, which was ultimately what everyone was more interested in anyway.
That's why people were there.
She claimed that Clara had once threatened to kill her. We don't have a heap of detail on this. We just know that Daisy claimed that this happened. What was easier to verify, though, were Daisy's stories about Clara's unbridled drinking and partying, as well as her gambling habit, although you could say the latter was blown out of proportion. Apparently, Clara's greatest gambling losses never amounted to more than $5.
Yeah, for some reason, it was apparently necessary to read a whole bunch of letters and telegrams from Clara's various boyfriends over the years. During the trial, like out loud, very
weird. Very American.
Super American.
I can still imagine that kind of thing being like, it's in the public interest.
Yeah, although these messages weren't explicit or anything, their overlapping timestamps greatly contributed to Clara's promiscuous reputation, let's just say.
Clara's testimony, as you guys might expect, did little to recover things. She was overcome with nerves, and it seemed as though her time on the witness stand was a train going completely off the tracks. As soon as she said her first words in her heavy Brooklyn accent, the crowd laughed. Her first quote on the stand was, "She took my dough, see?" And from that point on, it was completely downhill.
Yeah, while on the witness stand, Clara loudly accused Daisy of smirking at her. She got emotional. Her stutter reappeared. She sobbed openly. She was sort of stuck in an endless loop of one sentence due to her stutter. The crowd kind of went from amused to horrified. And the thing was, the public wanted to see Clara lose here. As per Run and Wild, the nation needed to believe the worst about its fallen idol. And although People versus DeVoe was literally Daisy's trial, an angry America charged Clara with frivolity and excess, traits praised during the previous decade, and found her guilty of each.
Ultimately, Daisy was found guilty of one charge of stealing Clara's money. Apparently, she had told Clara that one particular check had been used for income tax, when actually she had gone out and bought herself a fur coat. Daisy was sentenced to 18 months in jail. Both of the former best friends were devastated. Before the sentencing, Clara even publicly stated that she hoped the judge would be lenient on Daisy.
Bit late for that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really understand a lot of the things that Clara did.
I know. Well, this is the thing, guy. She was exhausted and she was pretty traumatized, and now she was without her best friend, and so Clara was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. The trial and the scandals from the past year made Clara's mic fright, what we spoke of earlier, worse than it had ever been before. In one particularly frightening episode, Clara actually grabbed a hold of the mic and started punching it during a scene, screaming and sobbing and swearing as she went. And if you can believe it, less than a week after her breakdown with the mic, things got substantially worse for Clara.
In March 1931, a magazine called The Coast Reporter published a story about Clara with the headline, Clara Bow, It Girl Exposed. The actual copy of this article has been lost to time, but author of Runnin' Wild, David Sten, verified it. So we know what was included. We also know that the vast majority of it was complete fiction. Let's get into it, Zara.
Yeah, in this article, and this article is so beyond horrific, The Coast Report accused Clara of having sex in public, having threesomes, and sleeping with married men. They described one incident where Clara slept with a married man in Mexico. Allegedly, when this man's wife found out, he ended up killing her and then himself. According to The Coast Reporter, Clara apparently felt no remorse about this. They also accused her of sleeping with her staff, her cousin, her female best friend. And they also accused her of engaging in bestiality with her pet dog.
The article also speculated about her mental health and used Clara's openness about her family history as ammunition to accuse her of being, quote unquote, crazy. In fact, this article even suggested that maybe it would have been better for Clara if Sarah Bow, her mother, had succeeded in killing her. As per Runnin' Wild, promiscuity and exhibitionism, kinkiness and incest, lesbianism and bestiality, drug addiction and alcoholism, venereal disease and family insanity. No movie star had ever been vilified in such an obscene and brazen manner.
I've never seen anything like this.
So outrageous.
It's disgusting. Finally, The Coast Reporter called upon Paramount to fire Clara, claiming she was morally unfit to appear in films. If Clara's reputation had been on a downhill slope before this article, you can only imagine that after it, she became like this total social pariah. Never mind the fact that the vast majority of the story was completely made up. The damage was done. It also didn't end there. The publisher and the author of the article, a guy named Frederick Gurnow, blackmailed Clara and told her if she didn't purchase the entire publishing company of The Coast Reporter for $25,000, they would continue writing stories about her. This should just be illegal.
Before Clara had to deal with that threat, however, the reporter Gurnow was arrested for spreading lewd and obscene material, which was illegal at the time. So, you know, he had a history of this kind of stuff. Thankfully, Clara was not required to testify at his trial, and the content within the article was not read out again as it was considered too obscene to be included in the court transcript. Gurnow ended up in prison. That did little to comfort Clara, though. A cruel rumor spread that Paramount were planning on firing her because of the bestiality rumors.
Yeah, after her doctors warned her that she was on the verge of a nervous breakdown, Clara stopped showing up to work. In response to Paramount's furious messages asking her where she was, she wrote a letter to them. In this letter, she seemed to explain herself pretty rationally and apologetically and explained that her doctors had ordered her to rest. She wrote, "I have found that nothing else except happiness and health count in this life. I have never had much of either, but I am going to find them both."
That letter was ignored. After everything that Clara had contributed to Paramount over the years, particularly the millions of dollars she had made for them, they completely ignored and then abandoned her in her time of need. Paramount's lawyer actually contacted Clara and told her that if she didn't show up for work, her contract would be terminated. Feeling ashamed, scared, and guilty, she agreed to return, but didn't even last one day, Zara, before going into a complete emotional meltdown.
Yeah, Rex accompanied her straight to hospital where doctors diagnosed her with a case of shattered nerves. Paramount were a bit stuck. If they voided her contract now, while Clara was on emergency sick leave, which she was entitled to, they would have to pay her a $60,000 settlement. But if she voluntarily left the contract, they wouldn't have to pay her anything.
Mm.
So they did something pretty manipulative and sneaky. Knowing that she wanted out of her contract anyway, they decided to get her to admit this publicly, putting on a show of regret and remorse. BP Schulberg, who, as we know, was now working as a senior exec for Paramount, essentially told reporters that he would release the poorly Clara from her contract right away, no questions asked, if that's what she wanted.
Yeah, although that came across as something that was generous, it was simply bait for Clara to announce that she wanted to leave her contract, which would allow Paramount to void their agreement without paying her 60 grand. And Clara, in her poorly state, fell for it. She told a magazine columnist, "I don't want to hold Paramount to no contract. I ain't been able to fulfill my obligations."
Yes, they tricked her into admitting that she wanted to leave her contract and then graciously allowed her to leave without paying her a cent. She was 25 years old at this point.
So young.
So young. So what happened next? Well, Rex and Clara got married in an extremely low-key ceremony in Las Vegas. They promptly moved to a 300,000-acre desert on the border of California and Nevada, and they lived together in a house called The Shack, because that was pretty much what it was.
Yeah, The Shack had no electricity, no indoor plumbing, no telephone, heating, cooling, or running water. Clara was desperate for an escape from Hollywood. She got it, and she loved it. She did make two more films in the 1930s, but her heart just wasn't in it anymore. Here's a clip of Clara promoting the last film she ever made.
"I just came back to do one more picture, and I hope that you all will like it very, very much. I would like to be known as a serious actress and obviously as a fit girl. And now here's a big surprise. I want you to meet the most gorgeous man in the world, Mr. Rex Bell, my husband. Hooray!" Say hello, darling.
Hello, everybody.
"I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, no food."
Why does that make me feel emotional?
No, genuinely, because I was like hearing that being like, oh my God, I don't actually think we've heard her voice yet the whole series.
And I think you hear all the things that have happened to her.
Mm.
And then you see, we'll post this video on our Instagram as well so you can see it. She's on a boat as she's speaking. Yeah, look, we haven't finished yet. We'll get to our proper thoughts and emotions at the end. But
she's very full of life there.
So full of life.
Mm.
In 1934, she was 29 years old and she had her first baby, a little boy called Tony. After learning that his grandson resembled Rex more than he resembled himself, Robert Beau refused to visit his daughter and the baby in hospital.
I would really love to do this series without ever mentioning that man again. But unfortunately, I think we've got a couple left. In 1938, Clara had her second baby. It was another boy that she named George. George did resemble the Beau side of the family, which meant Robert did shower him with affection while openly hating his first grandson. Also, around this time, just good for you all to know, Robert started referring to himself as King Beau. Then we don't know why. He just wanted to be called King.
Dare I say it's the perfect bow to finish his story on. It's just like ties it all in a bow.
Ooh.
After she had her children, Clara's mental health took a turn for the worse. Now, if we look at her family history and the stress she'd been under for so much of her life, it is not surprising that that happened. In the meantime, Rex had transitioned from actor and stuntman to politician. He decided to run for office, which meant Clara would have to show up as his proud and loving wife in the campaign trail and in the public eye.
Yeah, only she was in no condition to do such a thing. By 1944, she was really mentally unwell and she attempted suicide, claiming that she preferred death to a public life. After that attempt, she was admitted to a psychiatric facility, just like her mother had been and her grandmother before her. For the last decade, Clara had been convinced that she was suffering from a very long list of physical ailments. But her doctors didn't buy that Clara was physically sick. Rather, they believed that she was a hypochondriac due to the level of emotional trauma she had faced throughout her life.
Yeah, despite her stay at the psychiatric facility and undergoing hours and hours of therapy, she couldn't accept the idea that she was a hypochondriac and continued to insist that she was physically unwell. All of this placed a pretty huge strain on Clara and Rex's marriage, not to mention her relationship with her children. And so at this point, Rex and Clara essentially separated. They were never officially divorced, and he started seeing another woman when Clara was discharged from hospital. So she moved back to Hollywood alone.
Yeah, without her husband or her children.
Yeah, and once she got there, she basically became a recluse. She quite literally didn't leave her house except to go Christmas shopping once a year. She also saw her family, including Rex and the kids, once a year for Christmas.
To fill her time, Clara wrote letters. She wrote many letters to her ex-lovers. One of her ex-fiancés, Gilbert Roland, was her particular favourite to write letters to. She wrote to the producers of films she enjoyed. She wrote to the president. She wrote to actors she liked. In fact, she liked one actor so much that when he replied to her explaining how much he admired her work, she actually made the very rare choice of leaving her house to visit him. His name was Marlon Brando.
Oh, I love that story. Clara's favourite actress in her later years was, unsurprisingly, Marilyn Monroe. It's not hard to see why she felt like a great affinity with her. They both had mentally ill mothers. They both had overcome great obstacles to succeed in life. If anyone's listened to our Marilyn Monroe scandal series as well, you'll feel that quite deeply. After Marilyn Monroe died, Clara wrote to a friend, "I never met Marilyn Monroe, but if I had, I would have tried very hard to help her. A sex symbol is a heavy load to carry when one is tired, hurt, and bewildered."
In 1957, Clara's father, Robert, passed away. He was 84 years old. Clara was devastated by his death. By 1962, Rex Bell, her husband, now estranged husband, died suddenly of a heart attack. He was only 58. Because Clara was such a severe hypochondriac by this point in her life, she had been convinced that she was going to die before her estranged husband. When he died, she became convinced that her time was near also.
She planned her own funeral in extreme detail, relaying her wishes to her two sons. She even provided stills from her movies for the morgue to use as references when preparing her corpse. On September 26, 1965, Clara Bow was in bed in the middle of watching a film called The Virginian, directed by her ex-fiancé, Victor Fleming. At around midnight, her personal nurse noticed her head slump suddenly against her pillow. Clara Bow had died of a seizure caused by undetected heart disease, and she was 60 years old.
Clara's legacy is a layered and sad one. Many of her early silent films, the ones that showcased the true breadth of her talent and youth, have been lost, as we told you earlier. With the development of the talkies, many film studios saw no need to preserve silent films. It was historians who raised the alarm about the decay and loss of them. For some unknown reason, major studios weren't really bothered by the loss of their own legacy. And so all of this incredible art, important art, has just been lost.
It's crazy. A lot of the rumours about Clara persisted for decades after her death. For example, David Sten dedicated a whole chapter in Run and Wild to disprove the persistent rumour that Clara had an orgy with an entire football team. He clearly felt the need to do this because the rumour was taken as truth for years and years, all the way up until he was researching his book in the late 1980s. It feels fitting to end this series on a quote from Clara herself, taken from that tell-all photoplay interview that she gave when she was just 22 years old. She said, "I don't think I'm very different from any other girl, except that I work harder and have suffered more, and I have red hair. All in all, I guess I'm just Clara Bow, and Clara Bow is just what life made her."
Why do I want to cry?
I know, because I just can't even get my head around what the world put her through.
Yeah. It's such an interesting story. I am so glad Eilish convinced us that there was two episodes here so we could really get in the weeds of it.
100%. We wouldn't have been able to do this in one. There's just so much there. And as we said, we are recording this before Taylor Swift's album is out. But even just as I'm reading through this script, you can kind of see perhaps the thread she might pull on for this song. Because how fame can ruin people and how the world can ruin people.
Ruin women.
Yeah, is so sad to read when you read it like this. So with that in mind, a big thank you to our pop culture journalist Eilish Gilligan for such beautiful work on this. And to Annabelle Lee, who audio edited this episode, thank you. Thank you, Michelle Andrews.
Thank you, Zara McDonald. Thank you to everyone who trusted us that this would be an interesting series and for listening right until the end. We can't wait to plant flummadiddles into a future episode.
See you soon, flummadiddles.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Shameless Media.
This podcast was recorded on Wurundjeri land. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Oh, hi, it's Annabelle Lee and Louis Hansen here. We are your hosts of Everybody Has a Secret.
Woo!
Woo! We are here essentially just to let you know that we drop episodes every week now. Every damn Friday morning, we are in your ears.
That is so exciting. What a time to be in your ear holes. So essentially, each episode, we unpack the real life secrets of our listeners. So this is for everyone who loves, you know, just a little bit of gossip in their lives, which, let's be real, Annabelle, is all of us.
It's absolutely all of us. Don't lie. You all love gossip. So if you want to listen to our show, please do head to your favourite podcast app and listen now.
See you there.
Bye.